KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
We've got music from every flavor, so keep it tuned on 91.9 on that FM dial where you can turn on, tune in, and jam out.
Hey to all you fish enthusiasts out there. Whether you're an avid angler or just curious about fish, we'd like to welcome you to Fish of the Week, your audio almanac of all the fish. It's Monday, May 12th, and we're on a week-by-week tour of fish across the country with guests from all walks of life. I'm Katrina Liebeck with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and my co-host is Guy Uro.
And this week, we're going to be talking about a big fish, a beautiful fish, a bass. It's one of the world's most renowned sport fish, food fish, aquarium fishes. This week, we're talking about the peacock basses of genus Cichla.
And we are very happy to have Dr. Kirk Weinmiller, professor at Texas A&M University and author of Peacock Bass, Diversity, Ecology, and Conservation. Very warm welcome to you.
Well, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be with you today, and I'm always happy to talk about peacock bass.
Awesome. Okay, so we've been talking a lot about beautiful fishes lately, and when I think of peacocks, I think, okay, beautiful tail, they've got the flashy eye spots. What similarities, if any, do the peacock basses have in their looks? And since this is audio, if you could just give us a description of peacock basses in general, maybe like you just caught one, you're kind of getting a close-up look, you can look at some of the details. How would you describe it to someone who hasn't seen one of these fish before?
Well, they're all very beautiful, and we can talk about the different species later in the podcast. But what all of them have in common, and where I believe the name peacock bass comes from, is the fact that they have a very prominent ocellus at the base of the caudal fin, the tail fin. And it's usually very bright yellow or white, a ring around a black center. So that's reminiscent of those ocelli that you see in the male peacock's tail when they flare those tail feathers. Besides that prominent ocellus, most of the species are quite colorful. They vary a lot, and that's actually a huge source of confusion, particularly for anglers that go to South America to fish for peacock bass. They're highly variable, but a lot of them are either a bright yellow or a green coloration. Sometimes they have lateral stripes, often vertical bars. Sometimes brilliant flame red throat and belly. In some species, this can be just absolutely spectacular. They're just really beautiful fish, very strongly patterned, just gorgeous. They almost look like coral reef fish.
I noticed some of the fish have a really big hump right behind their head. Can you talk a little bit about what that is? Is that like a fatty, fleshy thing, and what's it for?
Yes, it is a fatty, fleshy thing called a nuchal hump.
Perfect.
And it's developed in the males just prior to and during the spawning season. And the question always is, what would be the purpose of a male fish putting a big lump of fat on top of their head? And my theory about that is it's sexual selection, and it's probably an honest advertisement to females that I am a robust male that has had a very successful year feeding.
Yeah,
I have excess energy that I can show you on top of my head.
Okay, so we got some fan mail darter, which is basically where people send us in comments, questions, feedback. This comment was from Loic, all the way from the Kingdom of Belgium. Listen to every episode to date. Really likes it when we position species in the fish family tree. And you mentioned all this diversity down in South America. So that said, where do these fish fall kind of in that really neat South American cichlid tree? Where are they positioned?
Okay, so they're evolutionary relationships. They're in the family Cichlidae, and they're in the neotropical clade. So all the neotropical cichlids are more closely related to one another than they are to any of the cichlids in Africa. So those are two very separate clades within the family. And within the neotropical cichlids, probably their closest relative are the cichlids in the genus Retroclus, which don't get nearly as large as peacock bass. Retroclus are rapids-dwelling, benthic-feeding cichlids. And then within the lineage Cichla, there's a lot of, well, controversy, I would say, to this day.
I gotta ask. So I know that we've covered, okay, this is a cichlid. It's not a bass, or at least not a black bass, what North Americans typically think of as bass. But there are striking similarities between the morphology of these two groups of fish. And as we've talked about a number of times on this show, morphology is very tightly correlated with kind of the ecology of a fish, where it lives, what it does. And it got me thinking a little bit about the North American basses and how they sort of partition their niches a little differently. So I'm curious if you could maybe compare and contrast the peacock basses with the North American black basses in reference to their ecology, how they might be similar or different, and then talk a little bit about where they co-occur and how they partition niches.
That's a really interesting topic. The comparison with the black bass in North America, they're what we call convergent niches, okay? Both groups, the peacock bass and the North American black bass, have large mouths. They'll eat just about anything that fits in that mouth. Although one difference is peacock bass seem to be pretty strictly fish feeders, as opposed to our North American black bass, which will eat, you know, frogs, worms, insects, small ducks, you name it. Peacock bass really strictly are targeting fish. They'll eat virtually any kind of fish that fits in that mouth. Hmm. And they are incredibly voracious. That's one of the hallmarks of their ecology. They are just incredibly voracious predators. And one reason that they're one of the premier freshwater sport fish on the planet.
I had a conversation with one of our previous guests from our Peninsular Florida office down in Florida. We talked to him about opossum pipefish, and he mentioned that when he goes sampling, they go electrofishing. They are catching like largemouth bass, Florida bass, in the same habitat as the butterfly peacock bass. And I'm just curious, from that niche standpoint, would there be any negative interactions between these fish, you think?
Well, that's a good question, and we just don't know the answer to that. Okay. I'm not aware of any studies comparing largemouth bass and peacock bass ecology where they coexist. I think there was some research done in Puerto Rico where both species have been stocked in reservoirs. But in terms of like how they're using habitat, a more fine-grained scale, I just don't know. It seems to me they would have very similar niches. It's a good question, and we just don't know. I would say that peacock bass are just much more aggressive feeders. To me, they're almost more snook-like than largemouth bass-like in the way that they attack a lure.
Okay.
It's just more hard-hitting.
Okay. So I got a question about kind of the angling aspect. You know, we get really nerdy on this show. I know we have a lot of scientists listening, a lot of graduate students. We do have anglers listening, and I think it's really important to understand the ecology of fish to be a good angler. So I'm curious, what from their ecology can we take and apply, say maybe in Florida where there's butterfly, peacock, bass? Can you tell us any more about their prey, like what species they're eating, and just any kind of tips for anglers who might not actually make it down to South America?
Well, sure. So they're actually pretty easy to catch. I had a colleague tell me once that they were dumb because they will hit just about any lure.
Okay, that's good.
I actually think they're very intelligent fish, and we can talk later about the ones that I raised in my aquarium at home.
Okay.
But I think they're actually quite intelligent. But they have a very aggressive, you know, feeding mode. And so what they seem to be attracted to is motion. When they see a fish of the appropriate size to enter their mouth, they go berserk. And this is why they're so popular with anglers. The strikes are just savage, especially on topwater lures. This is what's really popular with peacock bass fishing. They are very aggressive with topwater. I think two things elicit strikes. This is not unusual. I think largemouth bass are the same way. They'll strike out of hunger for feeding, but also when they're on their nest, they'll strike out of aggression towards something that's perceived as an intruder, a threat to their brood. And I think a lot of the really big ones in South America, and probably even in Florida as well, are actually caught off the nest. They're just really aggressive when they're nesting. Topwater will really elicit those strikes. And what a lot of people use for peacock bass are topwater lures that just produce a lot of splash. They're special peacock bass lures with propellers on the rear, propellers on the front, that just make as much commotion at the surface as possible because that elicits strikes.
Okay.
But they will hit virtually any kind of lure. Fly fishing is very popular for peacock bass, large streamers, shallow diving plugs, spoons. They're not that particular. And like I said, the attacks are just savage. There's no other way to describe it. I've fished for freshwater fish all over the world, and peacock bass for me rank right up there at the top.
Okay.
Just the power, the excitement of the strikes.
And I know they introduced peacock bass to Florida, I think it was in the 80s, and that was both for sport fishing and also to control things like Oscars and Mayan cichlids and others that have become invasive there. What other prey are they eating? Have you noticed them targeting those species down in South America?
So that's an interesting story, the Florida story with peacock bass. So you're right. They were introduced with these dual objectives. And I think the first objective to introduce another popular sport fish for what's largely an urban fishery in South Florida was very successful. I mean, you can go to YouTube and just search for peacock bass fishing and find hundreds of videos of people fishing in South Florida in the canals. So it's very popular. It's been very successful. People are overjoyed with that fishery in South Florida. The second objective, to control the very abundant and diverse exotic species that are found in those South Florida waterways, I think has not been so successful. And it's not because the peacock bass aren't going to eat all these exotic species. As I've said a couple of times already, if it fits in their mouth, they'll eat it. I mean, we have found Plecostomus.
We talked about them.
We have found those in peacock bass guts in South America. Other catfish with nasty spines, we've found them in peacock bass stomachs. They do prefer sort of mid-water, actively swimming fish. Minnow and tetra types of fishes, I think, are their preferred prey. But they can eat virtually anything in those South Florida waterways. But the fact of the matter is they haven't controlled those populations of exotic species. And again, if you go to YouTube and just search for fishing South Florida canals, people are catching snakeheads, they're catching Mayan cichlids, jaguar cichlids, Oscars. They're still there, and they're still fairly abundant from what I can tell.
I want to know a little bit more about this eye spot. You were mentioning it in your description, but I think... Oh, sorry.
That's fine.
Well, hey, we're switching off. I seem to notice this more in the neotropical cichlids than in the African ones, but this is such like an apex predator, top fish in the food web. Why does this fish need an eye spot?
Well, I have a theory about this also.
Oh, really?
Well, so there was a fish biologist named Tom Zarrett at the University of Washington who had a theory about the eye spot in Cichla oscillaris. And this was based on his observations underwater of peacock bass in Lake Gatun in Panama. And his theory was it was for species recognition, mainly for the juvenile to locate their parents while the parents were brood guarding. So when the fry come up off the nest, for several weeks, the parents will swim around with the schooling brood and protect them. Zarrett felt this was a signal that identified the species as their own, and that the main purpose was to inhibit cannibalism. And he claimed that they would not cannibalize their young because if they saw the eye spot on the young, they knew it was their own species. That did not make any sense to me. Peacock bass will attack aggressively anything small enough to fit in their mouth that's moving. And it doesn't matter if it's a different species or their own. And we have even found peacock bass in the stomachs of peacock bass. So they definitely will cannibalize their own juveniles. My theory is, and this was based on observations I made initially with Oscars, popular aquarium fish. Oscars also have an eye spot at the base of the caudal fin, a very prominent orange ring around a black spot. And to me, that eye spot in the Oscar very much is in the same position with the same size and coloration as the real eye on the other end of the fish. So the tail may be mimicking the head. Why would the oscar want its tail to be confused with its head? Well, they coexist in habitats with a lot of small juvenile piranhas that are fin nippers. And during certain times of the year when fish densities are high in the Amazon and floodplains, there are so many fin nipping piranhas, mostly immature piranhas, that all the fish just have their fins shredded by these fin nippers. I noticed that the oscars did not. There were other cichlids in the habitat that their fins were just all nipped up, but the oscars had hardly any nips. And I actually did a study and quantified that. And the theory was that if you're an oscar, you're big enough to eat a small fin-nipping piranha. So a fin-nipping piranha probably just doesn't want to approach the head of an oscar. Well, we tested this with experiments in aquaria by obliterating the eye spot on the oscars and putting them in with fin-nipping piranhas, and it actually did seem to work. We got a statistically significant difference.
I'd hate to be in the experimental group if I was an oscar.
Well, so the same thing may happen with peacock bass. And I've noticed that it's the large predatory cichlids that tend to have the eye spot near the tail. And the smaller cichlids, like dwarf cichlids, you really don't find that.
Interesting. I know when folks come up to Alaska to go fishing, we've got a lot of kind of very rural communities, largely Alaska Native, different cultures. During your travels down to South America, do you have any tips in terms of etiquette or being respectful to the communities you travel through to catch these fish, or even just handling practices or things folks should be aware of if they are lucky enough to go down and fish for these fish down there?
Well, sure. That's a good question as well. Most people that go to South America to fish for peacock bass, and it's become quite popular, they're working through outfitters, through companies. They've already set up permissions with local communities to do this sports angling. I think that all of them are working, as far as I can determine, very well with local communities and abiding by local regulations. It's actually been a very good thing for conservation, in my view, because you do see areas where there's overfishing by subsistence and commercial fishers. If you go to the major urban areas in the Amazon and go to the fish market, you will generally see piles of peacock bass for sale in the fish market. I don't think it takes a lot of fishing pressure to really impact peacock bass stocks. And there's a couple of reasons for this. First of all, peacock bass generally occupy blackwater and clearwater rivers that are very nutrient poor. They're very unproductive ecosystems. This seems like a paradox. The world's largest cichlid species are found in some of the most unproductive ecosystems on the planet. Very low productivity in some of these blackwater rivers where the largest peacock bass are caught. To get up to these really trophy sizes that these international anglers are targeting, it takes several years. We've done age and growth studies on peacock bass in Venezuela. An 18 or 20 pound fish is 13, 14 years old. It takes a while to grow them up that big. Any kind of fishing pressure at all is just going to truncate the age and size structure of the population pretty quickly. I've got a story on that that we tell in the book. From southern Venezuela. We went to an area back in 1993, I think it was, because I read an article in the major Dallas newspaper about some anglers from Dallas that went down to Venezuela, to the middle of nowhere, in the very southern tip of Venezuela. It was hard to get to, and a local outfitter took them to a remote river, and they caught all these gigantic peacock bass. And I'd been working in Venezuela for years, and I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to see this place. So I got a small grant from National Geographic Society, and with a Venezuelan colleague, we flew down there, found a local guy to take us up to this river to see if this was true. And I'll be darned if it wasn't true. All the fish, all the cichlotomensis, the speckled peacock bass, were huge. We didn't catch any little one. I think we caught one small one that was about 2 kilo. All the rest were above 16 pounds in weight. The largest one I ever caught in my life was on that trip, and it probably weighed about 25 pounds. We didn't have a scale large enough to weigh it. But that was my estimate based on the length and the girth. And my theory to this day is that there was probably a lot of cannibalism in that natural unfished population. There probably weren't any little ones because these fish were so large, they could eat them all.
Yeah, it's like our sheafish up here. Similar story. They get really big too. That's cool.
So that's what an unfished population looks like. There are other places I've seen where the commercial fishing was just rampant and unregulated, sometimes illegal. Very quickly, these fish stocks get reduced down to very low abundance of very small fish. In my view, it doesn't take a lot of fishing pressure to impact these stocks. Back to the sport fishing that's done mostly in Brazil. There's some in Colombia, some in Venezuela, there's some in Guyana, but mostly people are going to the Rio Negro Basin in Brazil. The Rio Negro is a huge blackwater tributary of the Amazon in Brazil. Most of these outfitters hire their people as fishing guides, as cooks, staff their camps. And the other thing that most of them do to sustain these stocks of large trophy-sized fish is they move around a lot. Because if you fish one area over and over and over, you're going to eventually impact the fish. Even if you're doing catch and release, you're still going to injure a certain number of fish. It's inevitable. And I also have a theory that these fish are actually smart. I think they eventually learn about lures. I'm convinced of that. Even though they have this innate behavior to go berserk and strike anything that's moving, I've noticed in some areas that are fished a lot that they will come up on a surface lure, for example, and they're coming up to attack, and at the very last second, they turn and they don't take the hook. And I've had people tell me that largemouth bass will do the same thing. They learn. Yeah. And so these outfitters in Brazil will move around to different places and try to get into like virgin water that hasn't been fished before. And there's so much water down there. There's no shortage of places to visit.
Wow. That's a bucket list trip for me. I just to get down there and explore it. We've had several shows in a row now where we've been doing kind of small, non-game, threatened and endangered fishes. And I think it's great that we cover those at the same time, you know, covering the sport fish and also talking about fish to eat is good. And so while I recognize that you don't want to overfish these guys so you can keep the population, keep it sustainable, are these fish good to eat? Can you eat them? Do they taste good? Have you tried them? And if so, what's your favorite way to prepare them?
These fish are very delicious. It's one of the most highly prized fish in the fish markets in South America. It's a flaky white flesh, very similar to, you know, largemouth bass or sunfish in North America. Very similar. I mean, there's all different ways you can cook them. When we're in the field camping, we fry them in the skillet, or you can roast them over a campfire. If we're doing a very quick meal in the field, sometimes we'll just scale them, gut them, put them on a stick, and just angle them near the fire and just roast them that way. Any way you cook them, they're just delicious. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So one reason we wrote the book about peacock bass is we wanted to try to clear up some of the misunderstanding about the diversity in the genus. And if you go to Wikipedia, for example, it lists, I believe, 16 species. We only recognize 9 species. And that's based on the work of a colleague, Stuart Willis. Now, this is an interesting story because Stuart Willis was an undergraduate student here at Texas A&M years ago. I first met him when he was a high school student looking for a place to enroll for college. And he was a big tropical fish aquarium enthusiast. And he came to meet with me and he ended up coming to A&M and collaborating with folks in my lab on some research. And he ended up at University of Nebraska in Lincoln for his PhD. And he did his dissertation on the genetics of peacock bass. And Stuart traveled all around South America, aided by colleagues in countries like Venezuela and Brazil, and collected specimens and, importantly, tissue samples of all kinds of peacock bass. And he performed a genetics analysis and produced a phylogeny based on genetics data. And he came up with 8 species. So some of the names that were previously available appeared not to be valid. These things were genetically so very close together, you couldn't really call them species. There's 9 species that we recognize because in 2020, along with a group of colleagues, we described a new species from Guyana, from the Essequibo River. We called it Cichla cataractae, the name designating that this fish likes to be in the river channel in fairly rapid water around rocks. And that's the only place you find it. That one was a big surprise because the first species of cichla described was Cichla oscillaris from Guyana in 1801. For 200 years, there was a second species in Guyana that no one recognized because superficially, it's similar to oscillaris, the new species. Incidentally, the way that I determined there was a second species in Guyana was by looking at photographs on the internet.
Huh.
There are hundreds and hundreds of photographs of anglers holding up their prized catch. And I noticed in Guyana that there was a fish that looked awfully strange to me. It was similar to oscillaris, but I could see very consistent differences in the coloration patterns.
That is neat.
We actually had an expedition planned by one of my colleagues, who at the time was at the University of Toronto, Hernan Lopez, who's an expert on neotropical cichlid evolution. So we were going to Guyana anyways, and I said, we have to catch some of these fish. And we managed to get just 4 specimens on that particular survey trip. But that was enough. We sent the tissue to Stuart Willis. He did the gene sequencing and plugged it into his phylogenetic analysis. And this form is not even closely related to Cichla oscillaris. It's actually in a different clade within the genus. So it wasn't even closely related to the species that it had been confused with for over 200 years.
Was it closely related to other, like, high-flow peacock basses?
No, not necessarily. There actually could be undescribed species that are still out there. I wouldn't be shocked. But at the moment, we recognize 9, and that's based on the genetic studies performed by Stuart Willis. He did an amazing job. He went all around Brazil, Venezuela, Colombia, which is what you have to do. The genus is broadly distributed, although species, some of them have restricted ranges. Then in terms of zeroing in on niche differences among the various species, we've studied that as well, and there are definite differences in the niches of co-occurring species. We did a study in Venezuela in a clearwater river in the Llanos called the Sinaruco River. Like most rivers in South America, it's very biodiverse. There are 3 species of coexisting peacock bass. One is very large and occurs in a variety of habitats, both in the river channel and in floodplain lakes, lagoons, oxbow lakes. That's Cichla timensis. This is the species that gets the largest, the one that international anglers go to South America to target. The world record on Cichla timensis currently stands at over 29 pounds.
Wow.
Whoa.
So these fish get larger than our North American black bass.
That is huge.
Timensis is found throughout the river, usually along the shoreline, sometimes over sandbars, sometimes in deeper shoreline areas where you have down timber and other structure, and also in lakes. Then there's a smaller species, Cichla ornacensis, the so-called butterfly, Orinoco butterfly peacock. They only get up to about 10 or 11 pounds maximum. Usually they're much smaller than that. And they tend to hug the shallow waters along the shore, particularly in floodplain habitats, but also in the river channel, if it's shallow enough, with enough structure. They like to be around structure. My observation is that oftentimes when you're fishing for the large peacock bass, the timensis, what they're doing is they're waiting for the butterfly peacock bass to flush prey out of the structure, out of the shallows.
Huh.
And when those prey go out into deeper water, that's when they get nailed by the large timensis. And then there's a third species that coexists with the other two in the Rio Sinaruco, and that's Cichla intermedia, the so-called royal pavon, pavon meaning peacock in Spanish.
Real creative Spaniards.
Yeah, there you go. And cichlidar media is restricted to the river channel and flowing water, usually around submerged structures. It's similar to that Cataractae species that I mentioned from Guyana. Now in Guyana, I currently have a PhD student, Ben Fry, who's completing a dissertation on the niche partitioning of the Cichla oscillaris in Guyana and the newly described Cichla cataractae that lives in the rocky shoals and the rapids and the Rio Essequibo. And he finds that there is very little overlap in the habitats where you find these fish. He's collected hundreds of both species, and they almost never co-occur in the same spot. The oscillaris is more in the floodplain lakes, quiet, slow-moving water, and the cataractae are in the fast-moving water. Interestingly, cataractae grows larger than oscillaris does.
That is interesting. I wouldn't expect that. I would have expected the more kind of lentic-type system to produce a bigger fish.
Yeah, which is what we find in Venezuela, in the Sinaruco. The larger fish occurs both in the river channel, but in water that's not too fast, and also in the floodplain. And the smaller species is in the fast water in the river channel.
That's cool.
Just the opposite in the Essequibo. Of the 9 species of peacock bass, 3 of them seem to be associated with fast-flowing water in river channel. The other one occurs in the Xingu River, a tributary of the Amazon in Brazil. So there are rapids, a whole complex of rapids on the lower Xingu. And there is a species described about 20 years ago by Sven Kulander, Cichla melanie, that is restricted to those rapids on the lower Xingu. That one, the royal peacock bass in Venezuela, restricted to the Orinoco drainage basin, and then Cichla cataractae and the Essequibo River in Guyana. Those are the only 3 that seem to be restricted to rapids and rocky shoals in river channels. All the other ones tend to be very common in floodplain lakes, in lowland river channels, where the water's not too fast. And as I mentioned, sometimes coexisting with these more rapids-dwelling forms, but you don't find them in the same pockets of habitat. They seem to segregate.
So we've talked about a few ways to interact with those fish. So you've got fishing for them, we can eat them, and you mentioned you have them in an aquarium. And there's actually a pet store up here in Anchorage, Alaska, that just had peacock bass, which I was kind of surprised about. So I'm kind of curious, what is the hobby situation with these fish, and what's it like keeping them?
This is another really interesting issue. Their popularity has increased amazingly in the last 10 years or so. And you can keep them in an aquarium, but obviously you need a very large aquarium. And you can see a lot of YouTube videos of people showing off their aquarium fish. And I just sort of shake my head, because a lot of times these fish are not housed in tanks that are nearly large enough. So my story is, during COVID, I couldn't travel to the Amazon. And that was frustrating.
You needed your peacock backs.
I needed some peacock bass, some contact. And my wife and I had discussed the idea for several years of building a really large aquarium at our home. But it was kind of a pipe dream. But, you know, we were bored. It was 2020 during COVID. And we thought, well, maybe we could do this. We found a local contractor to build a 3,500-gallon aquarium.
Oh, my gosh.
He actually built a whole little structure, a room around it that attached to the side of our house.
Wow.
So we have the aquarium room with this giant aquarium, and my plan was peacock bass.
Yeah.
How do I get the peacock bass? Well, it turns out you can find anything for sale online these days. So there are suppliers, online sellers, and I was able to find 8 of the 9 species for sale online, people who will ship them to your door via UPS or FedEx. And I bought all of them as fingerlings, as small juveniles, for 2 reasons. For one thing, they're cheaper when they're little like that, but also they ship better. A third reason is I wanted to see how their colorations patterns changed and how their behavior changed as they matured.
Awesome.
So I ended up with all these really big peacock bass. As I said, they are voracious feeders. So I started out feeding them mosquito fish out of my garden pond when they were small. After a while, that just wasn't sufficient. Fortunately, here at A&M, we have an aquaculture research station where they do a lot of experiments on fish growth. And when they terminate their experiments, they euthanize the fish and discard them. And I said, look, don't discard them. Freeze them all. I'll take everything you've got. So I had a good supply of feed for my peacock bass. So it was a blast to watch them feed and to watch them grow and to see how their color patterns changed as they grew. But I ended up with way too much biomass, even for a 3,500-gallon tank. And I have a pretty good filtration system, basically a swimming pool pump and a big filtration system, but it wasn't enough. So I gradually got rid of some of the peacock bass. I donated some of them to a public aquarium in Galveston. I just more recently donated the remainder to a public aquarium in Houston, Texas. And so I no longer have any, but when I got rid of the last batch, I had a cichlotimensis that weighed 22 pounds.
What was your favorite one personality-wise? Did you have a favorite individual that was particularly tame or anything?
Their behaviors are all pretty similar, although I did notice that species from the Xingu River, the Cichla melanie, the Xingu peacock bass that lives in the rapids, was a little more aggressive than some of the others. My theory is that's typical of fish that live in rocky shoals because they tend to be more sedentary and carve out their little territories. Like smallmouth bass are more aggressive than largemouth bass if you keep them in an aquarium. So I think peacock bass are the same way. I was kind of partial to the cichlotimensis just because they grow so darn big and they're beautiful.
Do you know where the folks were getting these fingerlings from that you ordered? Were they harvesting them from the wild, or are they breeding them in captivity? Because these guys have sort of intensive parental care, don't they? Do they breed in captivity?
They do. People have had them breed in aquaria. I've actually seen YouTube videos posted of fish in actually aquaria that aren't that large with spawning on a rock in the aquarium. So they come from two places. Some are imported from the wild. That's how I was able to get the fire peacock bass. That was one of my favorites, by the way. This one is just gorgeous. It's a beautiful, beautiful fish. Flame red over half of its body. Those, I don't think anybody had bred in captivity, so those came from the wild for sure. Nowadays, there are tropical fish farms in places like Malaysia and Indonesia where they're breeding them in ponds for sale for aquarists. This is actually leading to some contamination of the genetics. I'm seeing hybrids actually being sold as hybrid peacock bass for aquarists. That's a little troubling to me because you're going to start to lose the original wild type stock.
On the topic of moving fish around, it seems like, okay, putting them in Florida wasn't necessarily the worst thing in the world. But then you got examples like Gatun Lake down in Panama, where it seems like you've had some really rough knock-on effects. You know, you lose native species, you get increases in the mosquito population, and so it's not great. I guess another thing that's going on in my head is I just make these connections with American black basses, and what we've seen across the Southeast, particularly with Alabama bass, is these reservoirs get put in place, sport fish are moved around for sport fishing purposes, but then they go and they introgress and they hybridize with the native basses in the area. Down in South America, it seems like there's a lot of interest in hydropower development and building these reservoirs. Are folks moving peacock bass around, or are they keeping the native ones in there? What have you seen with this, and what have been some of the potential negative effects with moving peacock bass around?
That's a very good question. There are reservoirs that have been constructed, particularly in southern Brazil, in the Paraná Basin. Rio Paraná is a massive river basin in its own right. Drains southern Brazil, the Pantanal region in Paraguay, and then down through Argentina. So the Paraná never had a native peacock bass species. They didn't exist historically there. But virtually all the reservoirs in southern Brazil and the Paraná Basin have peacock bass stocks now. Most of them appear to have been stocked from fish from the Tocantins Basin. The Tocantins is a major tributary of the lower Amazon that flows from south to north and joins the Amazon system right at the mouth. And there are two native species of peacock bass. One is what we consider a subspecies of Ocellaris, Cyclocellaris subspecies kelberi, and then Cyclopiquetea, the so-called blue peacock bass, which grows larger than Ocellaris kelberi. Those were moved from the Tocantins Basin to populate these reservoirs in southern Brazil, I think because they were just the closest stocks. They were handy. There was less distance to have to transport them. So that's not so bad because there were no native species for these fish to hybridize with. However, Venezuela doesn't have a lot of reservoirs, but it has a few. And a really large one is in eastern Venezuela, Lago Guri on the Caroni River. It appears there are hybrids in Guri. They stocked it apparently with Cyclotimensis and Cyclaornacensis, and those two species are caught to this day in Guri, but there are also some very weird looking apparent hybrid peacock bass that are caught also. And the same is true in Lake Maracaibo, which is actually a big freshwater lake, natural, and an estuarine system in northwestern Venezuela. It's a closed basin. The Andes mountain chain kind of wraps around Lake Maracaibo basin. So peacock bass were never present in that little Lake Maracaibo basin, but they've been introduced. And there are also some strange-looking phenotypes that are being caught in Lake Maracaibo that are probably hybrids.
So you wrote an entire book on these fishes. Do you still have any unanswered questions, or did you get everything into that book that you wanted to?
Oh, heavens. No, there's so much we don't know about these fish. Only a few of them really have been researched in their native habitats. The stocks in South Florida, I don't believe, have been studied since they introduced those stocks. That would be a really good project for somebody. What's the community ecology of fishes in the canals in South Florida? I'm not aware of any good research project that's even examined that. There's a whole lot we still don't know about peacock bass ecology, and lots of work remains to be done.
Have we missed anything that you'd like to make sure you speak about? Or
we covered quite a lot of ground. You guys asked some very good questions. This has been great. Enjoyed visiting with you all about peacock bass.
Yeah, thank you so much. Okay, well, I hope everybody can get out there and live from, discover, and enjoy all the fish, especially peacock bass. Thanks for listening to Fish of the Week. This podcast is a production of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Region. We hope you continue to develop your interest and love for America's fish and the beautiful places they live.
Pennies in a stream, fallen leaves of sycamore, moonlight in Vermont, I see finger waves. Ski trails on a mountainside, snow light in Vermont. Telegraph cables sing down the highway, travel each bend and road. People who meet in this romantic setting are so hypnotized by lovely evening summer breeze. warbling on a wall. Moonlight in Vermont. Telegraph cable sing down the highway, traveling each bend and road. People who meet in this romantic setting are so hypnotized by the lovely evening. Summer breeze warbling of a melon, moonlight in Vermont, you and I and moonlight in Vermont.
Oh, I could only understand you, maybe I could cope with the loneliness I feel that comes with no hope of keeping you. 'Cause you're free with your feelings when it comes to the dealings of your body and your mind. And though I said I wouldn't be just one in a thousand, here I am standing in your line. Never hold them in your heart, even though you hold them in your arms. You just pass out your affection when I came in your direction. It must have been my time. And though I hoped I could be different, something special too, here I am standing in your line. 'Cause you're free with your feelings when it comes to the dealings of your body and your mind. And though I hoped I would be different, something special too, here I am standing in your line.
Show up in my dreams at night, but my stubborn old memory keeps holding on tight. Sure makes it hard to forget. She's about as gone as a girl can get. She's out of here, she disappeared without a trace. Unknown, she just dropped out of sight. Last seen heading right on out of my life, like a stranger I ain't never met. She's about as gone as a girl can get. Dropped out of sight. Last seen heading right on out of my life, like a stranger I ain't never met. She's about as gone as a girl can get. Like a stranger I ain't never
each other remains with me, though there'll never be another. Warm drinks, soft lights, slow dances. When two blue people were the victim of circumstances, circumstances. The wrong arms, the right time, circumstances. Was it chance or just the wine? Would it happen again if we had enough chances? Or would we even want each other under different circumstances? What is done is over and just a memory. The night fate set aside for you and me. Oh, but the dreams this foolish heart romances on the night when we were the victim of circumstances. Circumstances. The wrong arms, the right time, circumstances. Was it chance or just the one? Would it happen again if we had enough chances? Or would we even want each other under different circumstances?
Too many times I didn't try to hold you. I never kept the promises I told you. Now it's time I give in, I know, to the words that I should have said long ago. Lady, lay down me. Wrap on your love around me. I need you to stay. Don't turn away from me now. Lady, lay down. Been alone, I guess I've known about it. You gave me love and learned to live without it. Now that you've turned to go, let me beg you to stay the best way I can.